I kept looking at her, trying to catch her eye. I couldn't say anything yet. I could be wrong. Why wasn't she also checking that screen? They were focused on the other one with the four Secret Service men at the far end of the corridor. More mush was coming from TC's earpiece. Here they come. A few seconds later, the three world leaders walked out into the corridor and turned towards the camera. They were moving quite slowly so that Arafat could keep up. I checked Bill Gates. He was now sitting down and writing. I looked back at the other screen, then at Sarah.
Come on, look at me. Check the screen, do something.
She was oblivious to anything but the three leaders as a group of advisers followed them, clutching folders and nodding with each other as they walked.
Hey, let's give you folks a listen.
TC leaned over the desktop and hit a button on the console. A speaker in front of us burst into life. A very quick but calm New York voice was giving commands over the net. People were acknowledging him in just the same tones. It sounded like Mission Control at Houston. Small red buttons were now lit on three of the microphones on the desk. I checked Bill Gates. He hadn't moved. They walked along the corridor for a short way, Clinton between the two others as they moved in line abreast. A few paces more and they turned left into the reception room. I looked across at Sarah. She was checking the large green digital display clock on the wall. It was 10:57. They were right on time.
Hey, Sarah, isn't that Gatesy? You know, that reporter friend of yours.
I couldn't think of anything else to say. I pointed and everyone turned to look. Sarah took a step forward and looked at the figure sitting down, reading his notes.
Standing back, she looked at me. No, it's not. His hair is much darker, but they do look similar.
TC stood up.
That's it, folks. I've got to go.
He hit the console button. The sound and red microphone lights died. We all shook hands again.
I hope you people have a good trip. Ask these two nicely. See if they'll take you over to the treaty room.
Davy said, It's on the itinerary, after the alley. TC nodded as he headed for the door.
See you guys. Hey, Davy, don't forget 4:30 this afternoon. We've got that meeting.
They ran through a few details of their work admin while Sarah and I, the Gooseberries, just stood by, keeping an eye on the briefing room screen. We followed TC out of Crisis 4. When we were all out in the corridor, he made sure the door was secure, then turned right and walked off towards the fire doors with a cheery wave of the hand. A couple of Hispanic women came squeaking along in white overalls and white patent leather shoes, looking like a cross between cleaners and nurses, and talking at 100 miles per hour in their own language. They stopped as they passed us, nodded and smiled, then returned to their warp-speed conversation. We turned left and moved further down the corridor. Josh had an idea.
Hey, you know what? I'll go over and see if I can get us into the treaty room, and maybe even the VP's office.
That would be great, I said. Would we still be able to watch the press brief?
Sarah joined in.
Yes, I'd love to see that as well. I have...
Josh smiled as he put his hands up defensively, like a parent fending off an over-enthusiastic child.
Hey, no problem. In a few.
He turned and walked towards the fire doors. Sarah and I exchanged a relieved glance as Davy led the way. We stopped, two doors down. Davy grinned.
This is the best room in the house.
He opened the door. Inside was an open space, maybe 15 feet by 15, with stackable plastic chairs arranged around the walls, the same as in the briefing room. Beyond that, in shadow, was a single-lane bowling alley. The floor was highly polished lino. The walls were painted white and covered with a couple of posters of bowling teams, and pushed against it was a large wooden box, also painted white, with compartments which looked as if they were holding about 8 or 9 pairs of bowling shoes.
There was whirring and clicking as all the bits and pieces of alley machinery came to life, and the strip lighting along the alley flickered on.
Davy smiled back at us as he walked towards the shoes.
"I've got a great story for you guys."
By now the bowling balls were rolling up onto the stand, and the pins were being positioned by the machine at the bottom of the lane. Davy had his back to us, his shoulders rolling as he anticipated his own story. His head moved to look at us both again, and he pointed at the top pair of shoes.
"You see these?"
We both nodded. He looked back to pull them out. I took the opportunity for a quick look at Baby G. 55 minutes to go until the press brief. Davy turned round to walk back to us.
"These are Bell's personal bowling shoes," he said. "Look at the size of the things."
They must have been something like size 16 at least.
"He's a big man, all right."
Hefting them in his hand, he chuckled.
"You know the old saying, big feet, big—"
He suddenly checked himself, in case Sarah didn't approve. She was smiling. The shoes were white with red stripes. As Davy reached us, he turned them round and showed us something.
"See this?"
All smiles. He pointed to the back of the shoes. I saw that each had a little mark in black felt tip.
"One day Bell came down with some of his bowling buddies. He went to get his shoes, and a couple of the advisors saw this written on the back."
He pointed again. On one was the letter L, and on the other an R.
"There they were, supposed to be discussing world affairs, and his aides were suddenly more worried about how he'd react to people riding on his shoes. Well, Bill picked them up, and for a moment there was silence."
I could tell old Davy Boy had told this story many, many times, because the pauses were in just the right places.
"Yep, there he was, the President of the United States, the most powerful man in the world. And someone had gotten a pen and done that to him. Nobody was too sure how he was going to take it. Anyways, he looked down at the shoes and then Bell started to laugh.
'I'll tell you what, boys, this is just what I need. They are so darn confusing, not being proper shoes and all.'"
Davy started to laugh. I wasn't sure if the story was funny or not, nor was Sarah. I just took Davy's lead and joined in. I could hear Sarah standing slightly behind me doing the same. The laughter died down and Davy carried on, pleased with our reaction.
"And that's why it's still there. Apparently Bill says it cuts his prep time by a half, so there's more time to play."
He was going to put the shoes back. He turned away and took two steps. And there was a thud. Bill's shoes fell out of Davy's hands. There was no blood until he hit the floor, face forwards, and then it started to spurt from his head, dark and thick. I swung round. Sarah was in a perfect firing position, standing at 45 degrees to Davy, with her right pistol hand out straight, pushing the suppressed weapon at the target, her left hand cupped around both the pistol grip and the other hand, pulling back. She looked so relaxed. She could have been on the range.
"What the fuck are you doing?" I shouted.
What a bone question. I could see precisely what she was doing. I didn't know why, but I was half whispering, half shouting as she lowered the pistol.
"For fuck's sake, we agreed no killing. What are you doing bringing that thing in? We don't need it."
She just stood there, in a different world, calmly putting the pistol back into her waistband. This was out of control. No matter what happened now, we were in a world of shit, and I had no idea by whose rules we were playing. I started to move towards the door. She looked at me quizzically.
"Where are you going?" "I'm locking the door. What do you think I'm doing, letting everyone in? We're in deep shit, Sarah. Do you have any idea what you've done? This won't stop anything, it makes it worse."
I reached the door and turned the lock inside the tumbler. It was pointless going over to Davy. There wasn't a sound from him, and dark, deoxygenated blood seeped from his mouth.
I stayed where I was, shaking my head in disbelief.
It was under control, Sarah, for fuck's sake. Midday, the press brief, remember? What the fuck are you doing?
She started towards the door. I moved across her, putting my arms up to stop her.
Whoa, this is way out of control. It's time to stop this now and get help. Just get thinking of a fucking good story.
I pointed at Davy as I turned towards the door once more. Why has she done it? It took 2 seconds before it became obvious to me why. She'd stitched me up.
You fucking bitch!
I started to turn back towards her. At the same instant, I felt pain explode in my stomach. The wind was knocked out of my lungs as I fell to my knees. I felt a fierce burning sensation on the left side of my gut. The left side of my forehead hit the floor, then my nose. There were sparks flashing in my head. I tasted blood in my throat. I'd never taken a round before. I couldn't see Sarah. I was too busy curling into a fetal position as I tried to control the pain. I started a low, moaning noise that I couldn't stop. I slowly, slowly rolled my head to find her. She was crouched over Davy. His ID was now around her neck. At a casual glance, she would look part of the environment. Her loafers tiptoed around him, avoiding the blood, then took the pistol from his belt and the 2 mags from their carrier. I didn't want her to know that I was still alive. I lay as motionless as I could, eyes closed, trying to stifle my own moaning. It wasn't working. I sensed her standing over me. I opened my eyes. She was just too far away for me to reach her, even if I'd been able to. She looked at her watch, and then at me. The weapon came up and stopped in line with her eyes. For the first time in my life, I thought of someone I would miss, and I decided that my last thought would be about Kelly. I looked at Sarah and waited. There was a delay, but no emotion, no explanation. Then she said,
"You have a child now. I hope you live long enough to see her."
She lowered the weapon, checking her watch again as she walked away. The tumbler was turned and the door opened. I tried to shout, but it didn't happen. The only sound that came out was a weak rasp.
"Fuck you."
Blood sprayed out of my mouth. She glanced down at me, no reaction in her eyes. There was a pause as she checked outside, then the door closed quietly. She was gone. The pain was intensifying. I looked around frantically for a panic button or a phone, but I couldn't see too well. Things were getting hazy. 2 others left to kill him. My arse. It had been her all along. How the fuck did I not see it? Being curled up in a ball on the floor wasn't going to do me or the VIPs any good. I needed to do something even if it didn't work. As I died, I would at least know that I'd tried to right my fuck up. My vision was starting to blur. I was taking short, sharp breaths and my stomach muscles were tensing of their own accord. I moved my hand over a hole in my belly the size of a 5-pence piece and plugged it with my thumb. At least I didn't have to worry about an exit wound. I knew it was subsonic ammunition for the silenced Chinese thing. The round would still be kicking around inside me somewhere. I dragged myself towards the door, through a pool of Davy's blood, which had started to ooze across the lino. And I was just about to pull myself up to open it when it swung inwards and connected with my skull. Curled up again in pain as more sparks flashed up in my head, I was just about switched on enough to know that I was stopping the door from opening fully. Encountering resistance, whoever it was got their body weight behind the door and pushed hard. I was shunted along the floor until they could get in. It was Sarah again. She didn't talk, just closed the door behind her. Then, grabbing hold of my feet and avoiding the blood, she started to drag me face down across the room, grunting with the effort.
I felt as if I had a magnesium incendiary burning in my stomach. I tried to keep tensed up, and all I could see was a dark trail of blood where my body had just been. After 4 or 5 paces, she dropped my feet on the floor. I moaned as I curled up, trying to reduce the pain as she aimed her pistol at the door. It opened. Josh had good news.
"Hey, guys, it looks like we're going to—"
I tried to shout a warning, but nothing came. The expression on his face was of utter shock and disbelief, his eyes looking even wider behind his lenses. Sarah was in front of him in a perfect firing position, calmly pointing at his center mass. People take a while for this kind of information to sink in, especially if they're not expecting it. But Josh was catching on fast. Sarah maintained her very cool, controlled voice. "Close the door, Josh." His eyes flicked between the two of us, took in Davy's prostrate body, then mine, and finally settled on the pistol, no doubt trying to work out how the fuck she'd brought it in. "Close the door, Josh." If Josh was scared, he wasn't showing it. He was taking in all the information without saying a word. He did as he was told and then stood stock still, showing Sarah his hands. She said, "You will now turn around and put your hands on your head." He knew the routine. If you've got your back to the person who's pointing the pistol at you, you can't assess what's going on. "Move out of the blood, then down onto your knees. Once you're on your knees, you're very vulnerable." She had more instructions. "With your left hand, using your thumb and forefinger, take your weapon out. Do it now." I was helpless, just a curled-up bundle of shit. I heard voices in the corridor. I recognized the loud Hispanic accents of the two white-shoed women walking from the direction of the fire doors. Sarah quickly checked her watch again. Should I call out? I didn't have the strength. They wouldn't hear me. I looked over at Josh, who I could see side on. He was considering the same option. He wasn't flapping as he obeyed her, his finger and thumb on the pistol grip. "I am taking it out now, Sarah." "Good, Josh. Now put it on the floor behind you." Keeping his right hand on his head, he flicked the weapon behind him onto the lino. I could see the sweat coming down from his bald head onto his face, and the wet patches in the armpits of his jacket as he raised his arm again. Fear is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a natural reaction. You've just got to be able to control it. He'd been here before and knew what to do. For a moment, I had the strange feeling that I was in an audience, looking at actors on a stage. I knew exactly what would be going through Josh's mind. He'd be wondering how he was going to get out of this, and just waiting for the chance to do something about it. Anything. Blood is the same as milk. Drop a carton on the floor, and it looks as if 3 have been emptied. Davy's blood had spread outwards and was mixing with mine around my face. I didn't have the energy or inclination to move. I just spat from time to time to try and keep it from going in my mouth. Sarah threw Josh's weapon the length of the bowling alley, and the clatter echoed around the walls. She checked her watch once more. "Okay, Josh. This is what you will do. Are you listening?" He nodded. "You will take me to the diplomatic reception room. You will be my escort. Do you understand?" He was very calm as he answered, "I can't do that." Americans have this wonderful, total conviction about themselves and their country. Even when they're up to their necks in 10 types of shit, they have this unshakable belief that everything will be all right, that America is behind them and the 7th Cavalry will come over the hill at any moment. After being captured during the Gulf War, as opposed to asking for things, American prisoners would demand them. They just knew they were on the winning side. In the regiment, You always knew that if you were in the shit, you would never be left behind. And that was sometimes the only thing that helped you through. But the Americans believed that at a national level. I wished I had their confidence. Sarah couldn't quite believe what she'd heard.
What?
Josh said simply, I will not do that. There was a pause, and I watched Sarah's face for a reaction. It wasn't long coming.
Josh, you've got some thinking to do, and not a long time to do it in. Think about your children. This is no time to mess about with your family, Josh. Take me to that room or you will die. I've got nothing to lose. I'm going to be dead soon anyway.
She had certainly listened to my brief on how to get Josh to do what she wanted. She checked her watch. If she needed to get to the diplomatic reception room before the end of the coffee break, there wasn't much time left.
They're great kids, Josh. And they need you. You're all they have left. Besides,
she smiled her curious little smile.
You could even try to stop me.
You can't do that if you're dead. I'm either going with you or on my own.
With you dead?
In 10, Josh. I saw his chest rise and fall as his body took in more oxygen to suppress the shock it was experiencing. I could only guess what he was thinking. Do I die now? Or do I accept what she's saying and try to prevent it on the way? At least then I'm going to be alive for a little longer. I had blood in my throat and my voice was hoarse as I said,
Take her, Josh. Just do it.
He looked at me, and our eyes locked. I could see for sure what he was thinking now. You fucking asshole. No matter if I had known what she was going to do or not, to him I was now the world's biggest bastard. Fair one. I looked up at Sarah as she gave the final warning.
It's make your mind up time.
She didn't have long until the coffee break ended. He looked at the wall, thought for a few seconds more, and quietly said, Okay.
If you try to fuck with me, Josh, know this. I will kill you before anyone has time to react. I don't want your president. I just want the other two. But if you fuck with me, do you understand me?
He closed his eyes and nodded. When he opened them again, he fixed them on mine. I hoped my eyes were saying, I didn't know this was going to happen, mate. And I'm sorry. So sorry. But his expression told me it was a bit late for that. Now that she was going to have an escort, Sarah took off Davy's ID card and put her own one back on. That was detail. And detail counts. She said, Let's go. She stepped back from the door as Josh walked towards it.
My weapon might be hidden, Josh, but at the slightest sign that you're fucking with me, I'll ensure that I get you first.
He nodded, looked back at me and walked out. She followed without giving me a second glance. Chapter 28. Everything was out of focus. My head was spinning. I was losing too much blood. Between us, Davy and I had the lino pretty much covered. But now wasn't the time to worry about that. I had to accept that I'd been shot and get on with it. I struggled onto my hands and knees, sucked in a couple of deep breaths, and started to crawl over towards the abandoned ID card. Every movement was agony. With each bend of a knee or stretch of an arm, I felt as if a red-hot sore was working on my stomach. It took me what felt like forever to cover the 10 feet or so. My head was swimming as I tried to pull the nylon loop over my head without disturbing the injury in my guts. When I'd finally finished, I couldn't even remember why I'd done it. I began crawling to the door, coughing, spitting lumps of blood, moaning to myself like a drunk in a gutter. My clothes, face and hair soaked with my blood, and Davy's.
On my knees, I fumbled with the handle like a panicking child. It was a normal knob, with a tumbler lock in the middle, but I couldn't make my hands work. My fingers weren't listening to my brain, or maybe it was just that they were too slippery with warm red fluid. I knew what I was trying to do, but I couldn't accomplish it. Maybe it's true that your life can flash before you as you die. I was suddenly looking down a long tunnel, to when I was about 6 years old and fell through a glass roof into a garage. I'd been with a gang of older boys running across the roof as an initiation test. I hit the ground, cut and bruised, and had to fight with the door bolt to escape. I was so scared that I couldn't make any sense of how to pull the fucking thing across, and once I'd got through all that, there was no way I was going to show them how much it hurt. They let me join their gang. My hands started to shake as they slithered around the door handle. I was losing it. I knew I was going to die soon. I didn't care. I just didn't want it to happen until I'd at least tried to stop Sarah. I forced myself to calm down, take deep breaths, and tell myself what I needed to do, just as I'd done back in that garage. It worked. Help. Help me. I tried to shout, but could only manage a weak splutter. Not surprisingly, nothing happened. I couldn't just lie there in the doorway and wait. Pressing myself against the frame, I scrabbled and pushed myself upright and, head reeling, I half turned, half fell into the corridor. I bent over, leaning against the wall for support, my left hand clutching my stomach. Blood smeared along the white plaster as I stumbled towards Crisis Four. She didn't have far to go. If Josh fucked up and got zapped, she'd just have to follow those TV cables and she'd be there. My only hope was to find TC. Anyone would be a start. I focused hard. There was no red light on outside Crisis Four. Shit. I started to look for a fire alarm, though at that moment I didn't think I'd recognize one if it hit me in the face. I felt my reserves of strength ebbing by the second as I swiped the ID card through the machine and tumbled through the door. There was a picture on every screen, but they were moving in a slow spin, like a kaleidoscope. I started crawling again. I didn't know how I got to TC's chair, let alone off the floor and into it. All I knew was that, as I tried with every ounce of whatever strength I had left to focus on the screens, I could see her. Sarah and Josh had just come out of the kitchen area. The ERT guy hadn't moved from the area of the brown screens and just turned towards them as they appeared. Spitting out the blood and mucus that was gathering in my throat, I hit the microphone switch. Mayday! Mayday! Black man, white woman on the first floor! Mayday! Mayday! I didn't know if it would mean anything to them, but I hope they get the idea. There was no reaction from the ERT guy. Then all three slipped out of focus and became a blur. I screwed my eyes shut and opened them again, spitting out another mouthful of crap onto the desk. Refocusing, I could see the ERT guy motioning to them to either move out towards the staircase or go back into the kitchen. I lifted my head to look at the picture above, which was showing what was happening on the other side of the brown screens. There were a few people in plain clothes at the far end, but no reaction from them either. Fuck it. I tried again. All stations. All stations. Then stopped, my head resting next to the base of the microphone. The red light wasn't on. I started leaving bloodstains over as many buttons as I could reach, wishing I'd taken notice of which ones TC had hit when he turned off the speaker. I got a light. Mayday. Mayday. First floor. First floor. Mayday. The ERT guy was switched on and responded immediately, moving towards them. Sarah was quicker. She must have seen his face react to the message from his earpiece. She drew her weapon, instinctively aiming from the stomach as soon as it was free of her waistband.
Josh dived on her, but too late. She fired. The ERT guy dropped like a bag of shit. Then, within a second of the struggle, so did Josh. Fuck. What had I done? Sarah turned and ran as the corridor filled with blurred figures in plain clothes and black uniforms. The cameras were now cutting from location to location as the main control room tried to get a fix on her as she disappeared off the screen. I knew where she was going. I swiveled round on the chair and with my left hand on my gut, forced myself to my feet. The door shimmered in front of my eyes as if I was looking through a heat haze. I staggered into the corridor. I didn't look round, just turned right and faced the fire doors. There couldn't have been much of the stuff left to be pumped around, but adrenaline was getting me up and moving. She'd be here soon. The Secret Service would bring the principals down to the shelter until everything was clear, and she'd aim to cut them off. I crashed through the two doors and looked up just as Sarah was taking her last steps down the spiral stairs. She was going shit or bust, head down, pistol in hand. I couldn't think of anything else to do but throw myself at her in some sort of rugby tackle. Perhaps it would have helped if I'd ever played a game of rugby. I collapsed against her, throwing my arms around her waist and linking them together behind her back as her momentum propelled me backwards into the swing doors. She was still moving, taking me with her, cracking me on the head with her pistol. By now, I really couldn't feel that much. My arms slipped down to her legs, and she started to fall with me. The fire doors flew open again as we burst through. We both hit the ground and the doors swung back, trapping my lower legs. She was stretched out, her back on the floor, and I was wrapped in a mess around her feet. I could make out the pistol was still in her hand. My guts wrenched and screamed as I kicked my legs free from the doors and scrambled up her body, slapping my hand down heavily on her forearm to hold the weapon down. She kicked and bucked to try and get me off her. She was like an insect on its back, frantic to get upright. I became aware of screaming, shouting, and heavy footsteps echoing round the area, but it was as if a mute button had been hit, and everything was happening a long way away. I didn't care where the noise was coming from. All that mattered was her left hand, which was going for Davy's pistol now that she couldn't use hers. I could feel it in her waistband as I moved further up her body. Her resistance got stronger. It was as if she was having some sort of fit, her head and body thrashing from side to side. I put all my weight on her. It wasn't that difficult. I was fucked. Her hand struggled to work its way between us towards the weapon. Our heads were so close together that I could feel her breath on my face. I had to headbutt her. There was no other way. She reacted noisily. The three times I made contact, I heard the back of her head bounce off the floor. It was messy, but it slowed her up. My head now hurt almost as much as my stomach. I was in shit state. Keeping my forehead pushed against hers, blood dripping from my mouth and nose, I prized the gun out of her grip as she tried to clear her nose and mouth. I rammed the barrel into her windpipe and looked at her, my forehead still putting pressure on hers. She didn't return my stare as I tried to focus, just closed her eyes and tensed her body as she waited for death. Our bodies rose and fell with her labored breathing as the doors were kicked open, and I began to make sense of the shouting from behind me. The mute button had been deactivated. "Release the weapon! Release the weapon now! Do it!" I thought about it for the 2 seconds I would have before they pulled or shot me off her. Her body relaxed, and she opened her eyes and looked at me. It was almost an order. "Do it. Please." "Fuck it." I tilted the gun upwards, and it slid 2 inches until it jammed under her chin. Pointing it towards her skull, I let my head move aside. Her eyes followed mine as I flicked off the safety and pulled the trigger. Blood and splintered bone splashed onto the side of my face. I'd finished the job I'd been ordered to do. That was what I made myself think. A moment later, I felt the pain shoot up my arm as someone kicked the pistol out of my hand. I was manhandled onto my back. I looked up, and there was ERT black everywhere. Then Josh loomed over me, blocking out everything else, blood dripping onto me from the mess on his face. They tried to pull him off me as he started to give me a good kicking. It wasn't working. I turned on my side and curled up to protect myself, and through the haze I could hear orders being shouted and the general confusion around me. I was losing it. Josh was still screaming above me and managed a few more kicks. It didn't matter. I could no longer feel them. What I really wanted to happen did. I became unconscious. June 1998. I came out of the flat on Cambridge Street. Checked I'd put the key on the ring of my Leatherman and closed the door behind me. It was a strange feeling, being a virtual prisoner here in Pimlico. I'd brought plenty of worried-looking people here in the past, but never imagined that someday I'd be one of the victims myself. The debrief was taking forever. The firm were trying to strike a deal with the Americans. Both sides wanted this to go away, and they weren't the only ones. It had been 4 weeks since I'd come out of hospital, and I'd been confined to the area ever since, under what amounted to house arrest. I was getting paid, and at operational rate, but it still wasn't a good day out. None of my injuries hurt much anymore, but I still needed bucket loads of antibiotics. The entry wound had sealed up quite well. All that was left was a dent in my stomach, coloured the same vivid pink as the puncture wounds in my arm. Walking down the last couple of stone steps to the pavement, I looked to my left at the crowd enjoying an end-of-the-week drink at the picnic tables outside the pub. Friday evening's rush hour had turned the whole street into a car park. The traffic fumes were cooking up nicely in the early evening sun. The heat was unusual for this time of year. It felt more like Los Angeles than London. I crossed between the stationary vehicles, heading for the all-in-one shop on the corner. The Asian father and son combo were used to me now. Dad started folding a copy of the Evening Standard as soon as he saw me come in. I felt like a local. Weaving back over the road, I headed for the pub. There were just as many people inside, and above the din, Robbie Williams was giving it full volume on the sound system. The smell of smoke, stale beer, and body odour reminded me not to come here again. It did that every night. I worked my way towards the rear where I knew it wouldn't be so packed, and besides, that was where the food was. I'd started to recognise some of the regulars. Sad fucks like me, with nowhere else to go. Or office workers big-timing it, or old men smoking their roll-ups and spending an hour nursing a warm pint. I asked for my usual bottle of pills and, helping myself to a handful of peanuts from one of the bowls, headed for a booth. The one with the most room was occupied by an old man who looked as if he'd just come from a British Legion outing, all tie and association badges. He couldn't have been there long. His bottle of light ale hadn't yet been poured into his half a bitter. "Anyone sitting here, mate?" He looked up and shook his head. I eased myself into the seat slowly, taking care that my jeans didn't ride up and expose the tag around my right ankle. Taking a swig of pills, I opened the newspaper. It was all the usual doom and gloom. Ethiopian and Eritrean forces had stopped bombing the shit out of each other with their MiG-23s to give foreign nationals time to be airlifted from the war zone. That was the sort of work I liked. Just plain and simple war. You knew where you stood with that shit. I scanned the rest of the news sections, but there was still nothing about what had happened in Washington. Still no mention of the injuries to the ERT guy and Josh. And I knew now that there never would be.
Lynn had given me the American party line during one of our little evening rides around town. The press release was short. A stressed-out member of the domestic staff had become temporarily deranged in the White House basement. It was a minor incident, dealt with in minutes. The three world leaders hadn't been made aware until well after the event. The most the story ever got was a column inch in the following day's Washington Post. I was glad the ERT guy hadn't died. He'd just been wounded in a thigh. Something to tell the grandchildren about. Josh had got it big time in the face. Lynn said the round had split the flesh on the right side and made his mouth look as if it ended by his ear. I'd been told the surgery was a success, but I doubted he'd ever be modelling for Calvin Klein. My one hope was that his Christian thing would work in my favour. Sitting in the flat a few days earlier, waiting for the debriefing team to arrive, I'd been listening to Thought for the Day on the radio. "If you can't forgive the sin," the voice had said, "at least try to forgive the sinner." Sounded good to me. I just hoped Josh could get Radio 4 in his truck. I hadn't spoken to him yet. I'd wait a while, give him time to calm down, and me time to work out what the fuck I was going to say. I hadn't seen Kelly since the Americans released me into the firm's custody. We'd spoken on the phone, and she thought I was still away working. She said that Josh had called. He'd told her nothing about what had happened, just that Sarah and I had visited. I still had no regrets about killing Sarah. The only thing that pissed me off was that every time in my life I'd let someone get close to me, they fucked me over. Everybody, that is, apart from Kelly. It seemed to be my job to do that to her. I'd blown it again by making promises I couldn't keep. She still wanted to go to the bloody tower, and she wanted to go with me. 3 times now I'd arranged it, only to cancel at the last minute because the debrief dragged on. At least she was going to her grandparents this weekend. Carmen and Jimmy would spoil her rotten. I took another long swig of pills. Fuck the antibiotics. I usually forgot to take them anyway, and checked Baby G. They started serving in 20 minutes. The debrief was going okay, I thought, but you never knew with these people. I wasn't getting as hard a time of it as I might, mainly because Lynn and Elizabeth were potentially in just as much shit as I was, and were taking measures to cover their arses. Even so, every event of those 5 days was being dissected in great detail. Not documented, of course. How could it be? It hadn't happened. Not that any of it meant much. I was lying to the team, using a script supplied by the good colonel. I'd RV with him each evening, and the Serb would give us a few laps of London. As Lynn had said, "You need guiding, Nick, on some of the more, shall we say, delicate areas of the operation." And of course, to avoid the slight problem of the T-104, since not even the investigation crew would be aware that such things existed. The only ones in the know were lowlife like me, Elizabeth and Lynn. To the investigators, I didn't even have a name. I was just referred to as the paid asset. That suited me just fine. Lynn had already told me that I'd been sent on the job because, if anyone could find her, I could. But I knew there was more to it than that. It had become blindingly obvious that those two fuckers had known all along what she was up to, and thought I'd be so pissed off with her I'd feed her through the grinder without a second thought. They'd even known where she was hiding, but wanted me to go through the process of finding her. They reckoned that if I thought I'd tracked her down through my own efforts, and if what I saw on the ground confirmed their story, that would put me even more in the mood. There were still loose ends, of course. I still couldn't work out if Metal Mickey was part of Lynn's game or not. After all, Lynn did say he was loyal. But to whom? Fuck it, who cared? It just annoyed me that these people could never just tell it straight.
Why bother to tell me all that bullshit? I would still have done the job if I'd known the truth. The fucking games they played pissed me off, and worse, they put me in danger. Naturally, nothing in the big picture had been changed by Sarah's death. Bin Laden was still out there doing his stuff. Yusuf had closed down, but he'd probably resurface in a year or two. And I still wasn't going to be getting permanent cadre. They said I'd be a disruptive influence on the team. I'd try to get a bung instead, claiming that what happened in the White House might have been my fuck-up, but I did stop the president from being shot. Well, you have to elaborate a bit. It didn't work. Even the deafest old duffer in the pub must have heard their laughter. All I got was the promise that if a single word came from my lips that was off-message, I was history. My major concern now was, what did I get up to after this? I needed to get some real money together so I didn't have to carry on getting fucked over by these people. Maybe I'd take a look at the American Rewards Program. Bounty-hunting terrorists, white supremacists, and South American drug dealers wouldn't be so bad. Maybe I could try and recover those stingers from the mudge. Who knows? The bottle was empty. People were three deep at the bar, and it took ages to get myself another. As I rejoined my mate in the booth, I was again careful not to expose the light grey band of plastic around my ankle, housing its 2-inch by 2-inch box of electronics. I checked my watch again. Just over 10 minutes till the peanuts disappeared and the menus were put on the bar. Not that I needed one. I knew it off by heart. I thought about Sarah again. I'd learned more about her in my stints with Lynn than I had in all the time I'd known her. I'd always felt that she was holding something back from me, and in my stupid way I'd decided it was because she was scared of intimacy. Sitting back on the cigarette-burned red velour, I started to pick at the label on the pills bottle. The old man bent his neck as he tried to read the headlines on my paper. I passed it across the table. The night before last had been another hot and humid one. Lynn had picked me up as usual for our daily debrief on the debrief, but this time in his new Voyager. It looked like the firm's budget had got a bit of a boost this new fiscal year. The air conditioner was going full blast. The Serb, as ever, kept his eyes fixed on the road. "How was all this allowed to happen?" I said. "How come you didn't suspect her earlier?" Lynn kept his gaze on the real world beyond the darkened window. Elizabeth voiced concerns. He shrugged. We took a few people aside for a word, but there was nothing we could put our finger on. The false flag operation in Syria seemed like a good moment to put her to the test. Lynn obviously held a lot more pieces of the puzzle in his hand than he was letting me see. But he did tell me this much. The Syrian operation had only been taken on by the Brits as a means of checking whether Sarah was Bin Laden's best mate. It was Elizabeth's idea. Sarah changed the data, killed the source and covered her tracks. She was good at doing that. I thought back to her giving the American a round in the head after taking his clothes in the forest. But she wasn't good enough in Syria. Without knowing it, Sarah confirmed that she didn't exactly go to sleep every night humming Rule Britannia. It was then just a question of letting her lead the way to Bin Laden. The only problem for Elizabeth was that she had omitted to fill in the Americans when Sarah was posted to Washington. Lynn had turned and looked at me, as if to underline his next disclosure. "Things got slightly out of hand when Sarah took an active part in the ASU," he said. "Once that had happened, how could we tell our friends across the sea? That was where you came in." I let that one sink in amongst all the other crap I was trying to make sense of. The investigating team had been clutching at straws to explain Sarah's behaviour, and I wasn't doing much better. I asked him, "Do you know what turned her?" He seemed to know everything else. "We'll never completely know, will we?
People are still trying to fathom out T. Lawrence. And who really knows what made Philby and the rest do what they did? There was a pause. A team went to Sarah's mother to pass on the tragic news. She was saddened, of course, but very proud of her daughter's most untimely death in the service of her country. I thought her parents were dead. No, just her father. He died when she was 17. A team had been weaseling with the mother for a few weeks now. You know, trying for any links or information that may be useful. Sarah's father, George, they had learned, was a big-time oil executive who was a stern disciplinarian and a major league hypocrite. He'd spent his whole working life in the Middle East without ever getting to like the Arabs. Unless, that is, they were either royal or wealthy. Preferably both. And took to all things Western in much the same way that flies take to shit. The right sort of Arab certainly didn't include his lower-class domestic staff and their 9-year-old son. The friendship between Sarah and Abed had been perfectly innocent, the mother had said. The fact was, her daughter was just desperately lonely. But as far as George was concerned, inside every Arab was a rapist just waiting to get out. The two kids were inseparable. Sarah was an only child, pushed from pillar to post all her life, with a remote, domineering father, a placid, ineffectual mother, and no opportunity to make lasting relationships. You wouldn't need to be an agony aunt to understand her joy in finding a friend at last. George, however, was not amused. One day, Abed's mum and dad didn't turn up for work. Nor did the boy come round in the afternoon as he usually did. The whole family seemed to have vanished. Then, just a few days later, Sarah's father pulled the plug on her education in Saudi and packed her off to a UK boarding school. It was only after her father had died that Sarah learned what had really happened. She was helping her mother go through her father's things when she came across a gold Rolex Navigator. Sarah said, "I never knew Daddy had one of these." Her mother looked at the watch and burst into tears. The Rolex had been given to him by a grateful business acquaintance. It was George's prized possession. He had accused Abed of stealing it and thrown the whole family out onto the streets. With a reputation as thieves hanging over them, their chances of ever working again would have been ziff. They would have seen out their days as dust people, the lowest of the low, outcasts from Saudi society and living on the edge of starvation. Sarah waited until her mother had finished, then left the house without another word. She never saw her again. "Of course, I don't go along with all this nonsense about blaming everything in your life on the traumas of childhood," Lynn said. "My parents dragged me around Southeast Asia until I was 7. Then I went to Eton. Never did me any harm." The menus were being plonked unceremoniously on the bar counter by the girl who'd served me before. The thought of dishing out another 100 stuff and chips obviously didn't fill her with too much excitement. I decided on the pie and another beer. The same as last night, and the night before. A quick look at Baby G told me it was 7:48, just over half an hour until my RV. Traffic was still clogging the street by the time I left, but at least it was moving. I turned left, checked my watch yet again and headed towards Victoria Station. 13 minutes till the pickup. I turned two corners and stopped, waiting to see if anyone was following. They weren't. Crossing the road, I cut through a housing estate that was packed with K-Reg, Vauxhall Astras and Sierras, sat on a wall by the rubbish chute and waited. Half a dozen kids were skateboarding up and down the only bit of clear tarmac they could find. The slip road in front of me that led onto the main drag towards the station. I listened to their banter, thinking about when I was where they were. I thought of Kelly, the girl who'd had her whole family killed, and now had a stand-in father who constantly let her down. And worse than that, much worse, I was probably the closest thing she had to a best friend. Sarah's words came back to me.
You have a child now. I hope you live long enough to see her.
I cut away from all that and got back to real life by reminding myself of the two big lessons I'd learned in Washington. The first was never again to be so soft with someone who showed emotion towards me. I had to stop kidding myself that I knew or even understood that sort of stuff. The second was easier. Always carry a pistol. I never wanted to play Robin Hood again. It was last night as I sat, watched and listened. Sarah's words still bugged me.
You have a child now.
The Voyager would be arriving any minute. I looked at Baby G and thought about George's Rolex. And then I knew what I had to do. I wasn't exactly a top-of-the-range example for Kelly. But the very least I could do was be dependable. Maybe, just maybe, the one thing that Sarah had given me by sparing my life was the chance to do the right thing. Moving swiftly away from the RV point, I jumped a fence that secured a communal garden. Crouching in the shadows, I pulled the Leatherman from my pocket, opened the knife blade, and cut away at the plastic encircling my ankle. The pliers made short work of the half-inch steel band that ran beneath. I knew that the instant the circuit was broken, the alarm would be raised. Even as the tag was being binned in the bushes, the standby team would be running for their cars, getting briefed via their body comms, personal radios. Jumping back over the fence, I headed towards Victoria at a controlled, fast pace. Fuck 'em. What were they going to do? Well, quite a bit, but I'd worry about that when it happened. It wasn't as if I was doing an out-and-out runner. I'd be back in the flat on Sunday, talking to the morons about Afghanistan. The only difference would be that I'd have acquired two new friends with necks as big as the Serbs, assigned to guard me 24/7. Just in case I was overcome again by the desire to take a weekend off. There were sirens behind me now on the other side of the estate. They must be flapping big time to call in the police. As I neared the station, I just hoped the investigating team had kids of their own, and would understand when I explained to them on Sunday that all I wanted to do was take my child to the bloody tower for a day out. After all, I'd made her a promise. A normal person's promise. Crisis 4 is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Random House Group. Copyright Andy McNab, 1999. Copyright, in recording, Random House Audiobooks. Andy McNab has asserted his right under the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, 1988, to be identified as the author of this work.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.